So, hello everybody, very nice to see you all. Lovely to see lots of people that I've never seen before. I always really enjoy that, seeing, you know, new people that I've not encountered. I find that very uplifting, inspiring, exciting and frightening, all that stuff all at once. And I've been asked to warn Art of Priya's group that this is just the same old stuff, more of the same old stuff, nothing new. Okay, so freedom, big subject, very big subject, very emotive subject. It's a strange commodity, I think, freedom. I think it's an attitude. Banshee says it's a quality of mind. You can put two people in the same sort of situation. One will feel enslaved, confined, bound, restricted, oppressed, with no room to manoeuvre at all. And the other will feel completely at ease, spontaneous and free. Almost any situation, I mean, you've probably seen this in communities, you put two people in the same community, one of them sort of like a duck to water and the other one sort of, you know, like wound up and irritable within hours. Very strange business. The first person, the person who's enslaved and confined, will feel constrained to react, acting out, the same old responses, following through the same old patterns, the way they always do, with no room to manoeuvre, no choice in a way. The second will feel the freedom to rearrange the patterns and to set up more positive conditions. Almost spontaneously, they'll do that. And this is what we usually refer to this as creativity. You can see these two. Banshee talks about these two, doesn't he? As the reactive mind and the creative mind. And in any one moment, we have this choice to go one way or the other. And we can develop the knack, if you like, of tuning into that second method, that feeling at ease, spontaneous, free, creative, ready to sort of play with the situation and see what we can make of it. To put it another way, as Banshee says in Know Your Mind, at any one time we are either encouraging positive mental states or reinforming negative ones. Now in the spiritual life we need to be in positive mental states, very positive mental states if we can, creative states, as much as possible. Continually, if possible, continuously in positive mental states. Not just to survive the rigours of ordinary daily life, which is hard enough, but especially if we want to confront the realities of life, so-called, the big questions in life, the ever-presence, as I like to think of them, if we could only face up to them, impermanence, insubstantiality, unsatisfactoriness, or the inevitables, sickness, disease, old age and death, which will come to us whether we want them to or not. Yeah, they literally are inevitables. They're not necessarily popular subjects, are they? And one of the fascinating things I've always thought about reality is that it is as it is. It's just the way things are, yeah? And it remains that it is, whatever we think about it, whatever we feel about it, whatever we believe it to be, however we believe it to be, it doesn't make any difference. It is what it is. So, that's quite interesting, I think. It's very interesting indeed. It means that we can either attempt to align ourselves with the way things are, or do something else. And doing something else is usually much more fun. We can enjoy it some of the time. We're certainly familiar with it, doing the same old stuff. It's comfortable. We know it. It feels secure. And everybody else is doing it, so it must be okay. 9,000 lemmings can't be wrong. That sort of thing. Does everybody know what a lemming is? They're little rodents, and when they're in their sort of habitat and they get overcrowded, they sort of spontaneously migrate en masse. And apparently they just keep going to look for more sort of food and space and everything. And they'll literally throw themselves off cliffs in droves. So we can be like that, you know, watching everybody else go over the cliff, we think, oh, it must be okay, everybody else is doing it. I've certainly been like that myself. I've certainly done things just because that's what everybody else seemed to be doing, or there didn't seem to be any sort of alternative. Most of us are probably in the middle ground somewhere, I hope, doing all the practices to some extent, some of the time. Still to some extent at the mercy of our likes and dislikes. Still to some extent enslaved, oppressed, confined by our egos, by our erroneous sense of self, as Buddhism puts it. Through all my years as an order member, and especially working here at Padmaloka, and especially since becoming a public preceptor, there's one thing that I've noticed that seems to let people down again and again in their spiritual lives. It lets me down too. I mean, I suffer from it as much as any of us. So what is it? Well, in non-traditional terms, it's not knowing myself well enough. Not knowing what I'm like. And certainly, particularly, not really being aware of what I'm like for other people. And I know in the past, I think I've changed quite a bit, because people used to say all sorts of things about me in the old days. And I mean, I find it embarrassing sometimes when I think of how I was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I was a very different person, with very little regard to what I was like for other people, what other people's experience of me must have been like. I must have been quite painful to be with sometimes, in all sorts of ways, which I won't go into. So in a way, yeah, this particularly being only partially aware of what one is like for other people. Not knowing or being aware of the effect that one has on other people. This is the big one in my experience. Just watching people, you know, Mitras of Ask Ordination, new order members, old order members, prospective private preceptors, prospective public preceptors, myself. This is the big one. This is the big one. And the way to counteract this, of course, is to have recourse to spiritual friends, to encourage them to give us feedback and to listen closely to that feedback and take it to heart, however painful it may be. It is very painful. I find it acutely painful myself to receive feedback from people. And at the same time, there's a sort of there's a tremendous sort of satisfaction in it. I don't know if you can sort of relate to that. It's like I feel like I'm seen, and there's something very positive about really being seen, even though what they're seeing is sort of, you know, not very nice and makes one feel painful. I find there's this positive sort of response to, ah, yes, I've actually been seen. Much more than if somebody sort of pays me a compliment that I know doesn't quite fit me. I find that much more uncomfortable and in a way more painful in a certain kind of way. It's certainly not satisfying. We need feedback from trusted others. Others who are more experienced than us, and perhaps even wiser, that's a possibility, than us. And of course one has to learn that by experience, you know, who is wiser than us, because, you know, just because somebody's got one of these, or that it's a particular colour, and I don't mean dirty, you know, I mean gold or something like that, doesn't mean they're particularly sorted out, or that they really know what they're talking about, and that they can see you any clearer than they can see themselves. Some people are very good at giving feedback without, you know, sort of taking it back. That's another sort of syndrome that one notices sometime. We need this feedback from trusted others. This is what we're trying to encourage in the order at large. This is the public preceptors. And I don't know how sort of aware of this you are. There's this process of scrutiny for prospective private and public preceptors. So what happens is that a notice goes in Shabda, and then anybody who knows anything about them, who has any sort of opinion, particularly a critical opinion, is invited to write to a third party and voice their criticism to that person. And then the person will go to the prospective preceptor and say, well, you know, this is what I'm hearing. What do you think about that? And if it's appropriate, put the two people in contact. So like lots of feedback and lots of engaging with a process of sort of scrutiny and, in a way, self-scrutiny. And this is going on with prospective private preceptors. It's going on with prospective public preceptors. And only when everybody's sort of reasonably happy, you know, the prospective person is engaged with their process to the extent that everybody's quite happy. And usually all people want to hear is that they're actually being listened to for a change, and then usually they're quite happy to accept that. I heard of one person, there's a particularly exemplary Dharmacharini who went round and saw everybody who had any sort of criticism of her at all. And she said on a number of occasions, she'd go and listen to people telling her what she was like, and she'd say, yes, I was like that. And usually it was women, other women, and they'd go, ah, they'd burst into tears. You said, what's the matter? You listen to me, that's all I needed to hear. People just, all that's all people usually want, just to be acknowledged, just to realise that, yes, this person has actually heard and acknowledged what they were like for me, whatever they think they were like for themselves. So, this is going on, and even the old lags like myself, we're all going to get this too, when there's a bit more space in the system, we're going to come up for a sort of MOT, a review. Yeah? And our names will go in Shabda, and I mean, we can't stop being private and public preceptors of the people we've already ordained privately and publicly, but if we're not up to scratch, we won't be allowed to perform any more ordinations until such time as we put right whatever the criticism is. This is what's going on in the order, and I think it's great. It's sort of long overdue, because there are lots of unfortunately lots of sort of unresolved issues in the order. So I'm thinking this is going to be really good. This is really going to sort of open things up in a very positive kind of way, just in the order. And it's certainly going to be, I think, for your benefit if you're not already ordained. I hope you can come into that sort of free atmosphere of, it's effectively, you know, what Banty calls a vital mutual responsiveness. We're all listening to each other and how we feel and think about each other, and feeding that back where it's appropriate in a positive kind of way. So don't wait until you become a public preceptor. Don't wait until you become a private preceptor. Don't wait until you become an order member or a Kalyana Mitra to somebody. Don't wait until you get ordained. Develop that habit now. Yeah, as soon as possible, get into and establish this positive habit of getting feedback from other people, wherever you can, from whoever you can. Especially if you're in a community, it's perfect, because they in a community, I mean, usually people haven't got a vested interest in you. Do you know what I mean? There's no reason why they need to tell you what they think you might want to hear. They'll tell you what they actually think and feel, generally speaking. They'll be honest with you. So go for that feedback. Get that feedback from your fellow community members. Get it from your Going for Refuge group. Get it from the people in your local Sangha. Go and ask them what they think of you. You know, how do I come across? What am I like for you? When we're having conversation, and listen to it, listen to what they say. The sooner we become comfortable with this habit, the better. So we need to collect trusted people at all levels, not just peers, not just seniors, juniors as well. Yeah, because it all has an effect. I mean, I've also seen. I mean, maybe I've done this myself. I've seen sort of older members in delivering a sort of meditation class, and they're wittering on, and you can see even quite new people are sort of going, this is a bit funny. But nobody actually says anything. You know, they're actually able to sort of carry on, sort of droning on, perhaps sometimes a rather long-winded kind of way, and nobody actually gives them any feedback. It does happen. And sometimes it's very difficult because, people get reactive when they get feedback. But don't let that put you off. Get into the habit as soon as you can. I've got a personal rule of thumb. If one person gives me feedback, what I try to do is bounce it off somebody that I know and trust, especially if it's somebody I don't know. If they say, oh, I find you're like this. I do my own sort of self-evaluation. And then if there's any doubt, I go and see one of my friends and say, look, I've had this feedback. What do you reckon on that? And they'll say, well, maybe or maybe not. If three people give me the same piece of feedback, I decide that I'm wrong. Yeah? One, I could sort of argue with. Three people giving me the same feedback means that I'm wrong. Yeah? There's something I'm doing that I need to change. And then I try to change that behaviour, or at least bear it in mind as strongly as I can. What I thought I'd do is I'd sort of give you some encounters with freedom, as it were. As I said, freedom's a, what did I say? It's a sort of, it's a strange commodity, an attitude or a quality of mind. And one's response to it can be different in different circumstances. So I just had a little think of a few sort of encounters that I'd had with freedom in the broadest sense. And maybe I'll say something about them as I go on. The oldest one I remember goes back to when I was about somewhere between 8 and 12, I suppose. I mean, I'm quite old, so we're going back sort of, you know, like just before and during the very early days of the telly, yeah, the television, TV. Very early days of television. Sunday afternoon was an encounter with freedom. Because there was nothing to do. There was nothing on the box except religious stuff. There was nothing on the radio except, you know, I mean, I was, you know, 8 to 12. It was all old people's stuff on the radio. And I used to get incredibly bored. You know, it's like, you know, what to do? All this energy. And, you know, like, and there's only like 6 hours before I go to bed. And then Monday morning I've got to go to school. You know, it's like I desperately wanted to do something that would have some meaning. But I couldn't find anything. So I'd be bored. It's interesting now because I can't remember the last time in recent years that I've been bored. I haven't had the time to be bored, which is quite interesting. So that was my first one, Sunday afternoons. I mean, I think maybe that's a particularly, it might be a particularly English working class phenomena. You know, the sort of the dullness and boondocks of Sunday afternoon. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that. Are you all looking a bit? Oh, one or two people can. Yeah, good. Next one. So that's got a particular flavour, yeah? That response to sort of open, as it were. It's a response to the open. Was just boredom. You know, there was nothing in it for me, nothing to fill me, so to speak. Next one, well, two next ones occurred sort of round about the ages of 12 to 16. You'll probably laugh at these, but it is a bit of sort of self-revelation, so you might find it interesting. I got a bicycle. My parents gave me a bicycle, and I should have named my bicycle Freedom, because on a Sunday afternoon I could get out the door on the bicycle and explore, and I just got into doing that more and more. Whenever I had any spare time, I'd go off on the bicycle and just explore the roads and the area around where I lived. I loved my bicycle and the freedom that it gave me. The other place that I experienced freedom was the Boy Scout camp. I belonged to a Boy Scout troop, and it wasn't a very sort of regimental one. We were pretty laid back, as they say, and we just go off into the countryside with our old ex-army canvas tents and run wild for a weekend or a week or 2 weeks. And I loved it. Again, I loved it. It got me away from the oppression, if you like, of my family. I mean, I love them dearly. I think there's no unfinished business with my family, but I was pleased to get away. If I couldn't get away on the bicycle, I wanted to get away and go to Boy Scout camp. In nature, you know, handfuls of dirt in the food and, you know, bits of charcoal because you've got an open fire. No primer stoves in those days. Lovely stuff. The next encounters are sort of, they span a sort of whole era, probably from about 12 onwards. And they crop up in pop songs. I encountered sort of freedom in pop songs. I don't know if you can relate to this. Maybe you can't. One of the first I remember is an expression that Bob Dylan coined, where he talked about, you know, that we live in the free West. And I can remember sort of thinking about the free West. Well, in what sense is the West free? And all that kind of thing. It just sort of, somehow I resonated with that expression, the free West, and started trying to sort of make some evaluation of whether I thought that was the case. He obviously criticised it in the particular song. I can't remember which one now. There was another song that I remember very much, and I was always very interested in the lyrics in pop songs. I think this was, you know, it was the best I could do as a working class lad, in my sort of gropings towards poetry. I got there in the end, but to begin with, all I had available to me really was the lyrics of pop songs, and they were desperately important to me usually. And there was a particular song where I don't think I'll try singing it, but the line went, "Freedom is just another word for nothing left to do." And that really sort of, again, that resonated with me, like, nothing left to do. I think this got me sort of searching for some sort of meaning in my life. And it definitely resonated with Sunday afternoons. You know, yes, Sunday afternoons were free, but, you know, nothing left to do. Is it? Lose? Yeah. That's right. Thank you. Right. Okay, moving swiftly on. I think I've got this lyric right. This is from the Beatles. I think it's on Abbey Road, where that magic feeling, nowhere to go. Yeah, and I still encounter that sometimes. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. You've made this arrangement to meet somebody or do something, and it's going to be quite difficult. It's going to take quite a lot of time. You get there, you're on time, a bit apprehensive, and then for some reason or another, it's cancelled. And there's this magic feeling, like nowhere to go. You've got this space in front of you. Instead of a lot of hard work or whatever it is, there's this magic feeling of nowhere to go. You know, suddenly you've got 2 hours where you can just do what you like. Maybe that's a mark of the way my life has changed these days. You know, the magic feeling of nowhere to go is quite rare. I don't experience that very often anymore. But it is a magic feeling. I do like it. Yeah. Next one. This is an interesting one. This is very powerful. I'm not quite sure what it meant, but I'm about 19. I've just passed my driving test. I've got my dad's car, and I'm taking my girlfriend out for a drive in my dad's car. And I felt amazing. We didn't do anything. There's a, you know, again, working class lad a long time ago. We didn't do that sort of thing. But just to be in this car, you know, with this girl next to me, I got this incredible sort of, I think it was maybe a sort of the beginnings of a sort of an experience of my own, I don't know, potency or power, maybe something like that, I don't know. But I can remember it was a feeling in my chest. I felt really sort of full and happy and positive out in my dad's car. Next one. I think it's the same girlfriend. Aged 23, I called off my marriage. I was engaged to be married. We'd had the bands red. I didn't have a suit. She didn't have a dress, and we didn't have anywhere to live. We'd done everything else. And it's quite, I don't know if you've ever been through this process, but it's quite a thing to set up. You know, with all this, people have been giving us presents and all the rest of it. There was all this stuff at home. And I called it off. I couldn't go through with it. And I got an incredible sense of release from that. An incredible sense of just freedom, I suppose. Incredible sense of freedom, which has stayed with me ever since and seen me in very good stead, I think. Next one, I think was age 26, 25, 26, I met Subhuti and Buddhism in very quick succession. As Banti says in his lecture, Subhuti and Buddhism, even dry academic Buddhism, really had the taste of freedom for me. I thought, this is it, this is what I do with my life, this is the meaning I've been looking for, this is the purpose. And again, a sort of an incredible sense of the oppression of worldly life to some extent, I felt sort of fall away. It was a very sort of exciting time for me. Interestingly enough, I don't remember experiencing this when I got ordained. It's interesting that Padmavajra experienced, you know, a sense of sort of uplift, an inspiration when he was ordained. I think I was too self-centred and unintegrated for that. I just felt a bit smug. I've even got this picture of me standing there with my two Kalyanamitras, and I'm sort of I've got the cream sort of thing. Real, full of myself. Unfortunately. But things have turned out quite a bit different from that. Next one. I've only got a few more to go and then I'll finish. Next one. I'm 31. I've been ordained about 5 years. How to put this? I fell in love with a French woman. And she went back to France, so I tidied up my affairs, sold lots of things, and I went off to France with just a rucksack. And I didn't know if I was ever coming back. I really didn't know if I was coming back. I didn't have a two-way ticket, I just had a one-way ticket, and I didn't know what the future held. And I just sort of launched myself into the open again, in a way, without, you know, not knowing what was going to come. And that was a very sort of double-edged thing. It was very exciting, but also very very frightening to sort of launch myself off like that. But it's interesting. I mean, thinking about it now, I don't know how I managed to do it. I'm sort of amazed that I had the gall just to go off. And I suppose the way people put it these days is that I, in a way, I was following a dream of some sort. I went off following this dream on my own. I came back pretty quickly because it was hell out there, basically. I think in a way it was very good for me. One of the things it did was it made me realise when I came back, because once things got pretty bad, I decided to come back. I'm not completely stupid, so I came back. I came back to the order, and I can remember my first National Order weekend in the LBC. I think it was the LBC. We all used to sit around in a great big circle, a bit like this. You'd have as many people as this, all sitting around the walls of this room. And we'd all report in one at a time to everybody else. It seems a bit ludicrous now, but it was very good sometimes. Very, very good indeed. And over again, people kept saying, "Oh, it's so good to see Surita back." And I thought, well, I don't need to do this again. You know, I don't need to leave. I can just do what I like. It is my life, I suppose. That was the sort of the penny that dropped. I think the next big thing, and there have been lots of little ones since, encounters with freedom, but again, a very double-edged one was, I think, going to India with Loka Mitra in, whenever it was, I think 1980, maybe, something like that. First time anybody from the movement had been back to India. That's right, 78. Yeah, I think I'd been ordained about 2 years. Yeah, it was the first time anybody had gone back to India. Anybody who'd had anything to do with Bhante. So, we got to Delhi Airport and there was no reception committee. We were on our own in Delhi Airport. What is it, nearly 30 years ago, a long time ago, things were very different. I mean, I've not been back to India, but people tell me that it's changed quite a lot. We were sort of thrust into the, certainly for a European, an Englishman, thrust into the madness and chaos of India, which in the space of, I think, 2 short months, I learnt to love. I really loved India, but... It was a hell of a time because I really felt like everything changed when I got to India. There was nothing about any of my experience except my sadhana, I think, that remained the same. All the people that I went with, as far as I was concerned, turned into maniacs almost as soon as we touched down, and that included, senior order members. They just went completely berserk. People, it seemed to bring out the worst in people. Certainly brought out the worst in me. I really had the feeling, when I went to India, I had the sense that I could die out there. I could die and never come back when I went. Because I think maybe 6 months before I went, I knew somebody who went over there, contracted hepatitis and died within about 5 days. So I thought, God, this could happen to me. I could die, in India. So it was a really big deal going to India. And as I say, at the end of 2 months, I loved it. I really loved it. And I realised that if by some fluke I'd have had the balls, as it were, to go out there, like 10 years earlier, I probably would never have come back once I'd got over the culture shock. I would have just got completely sort of lost in the way India does things. And you, I mean, I don't know if it's still like that, but certainly went that, on that first trip, I saw people. I saw Westerners who'd become quite sort of Indianized. It was quite an interesting sort of thing to watch and see. Okay, to finish. I found this interesting. I haven't really sort of finished thinking about this yet, but today Lokeshwara came into my room and he said to me, he knows I was writing this talk on freedom, he said, do you experience freedom in your day-to-day life here at Padmaloka? And I thought a bit, and then I said to him, I mean, I was a bit preoccupied, I said to him, yes, except for the constraints that I put upon myself, which I thought was a very interesting thing to say. So maybe I've learned something over the years after all. Okay, I think that'll do. My time is up.